You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Tom Hartman.
To you.
Doctor of democracy? I don't know. Limbaugh calls himself that, but I don't think he has a PhD. Anyway, there's a lot going on in the world, and I'm back. And the Pope had some interesting things to say. You cannot worship God and money. We'll get into that in some more detail as we continue through the day. But one of the questions that has been asked, you know, that was asked back in the 30s, I mean, for 3 years after the Great Depression in 1929, by and large, the efforts to solve the Great Depression by Herbert Hoover and Mr. Morgan, as I recall, his Secretary of the Treasury, were to, you know, be hands-off, basically. Liquidate everything, right, was Morgan's famous statement, as I recall. And as opposed to regulating things, and FDR came in and started regulating things seriously. For example, Glass-Steagall telling banks, you've got to make a choice. You can either be a gambling bank, like Merrill Lynch used to be, basically a brokerage house, or you can be a checkbook bank, commercial bank, and write mortgages and keep people's money in their checkbooks. But you can't be both. We deregulated that in 1999, and well, wasn't that wonderful? So what do we do? How do we, you know, how did we get here, and how do we get out of here? Bill Frezza has some thoughts on this. He's an adjunct scholar with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. And asserts, Bill, correct me if I'm wrong, that deregulation is causing our economic crisis and maintaining it?
I don't know that I've ever said that.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know that we've had much deregulation. Glass-Steagall certainly...
Excuse me, regulation. That regulation is causing our... I misspoke.
I'll sign on for that one. I think that we've got the worst of all worlds right now. We've got... too big to fail banks running amok.
Right.
I'll agree with you on that. And they're now being protected by their so-called regulators.
Right.
Outwit these.
Bill, pardon my interrupting you, but your line is so bad. Every word you say gets covered with a huge pile of static. I'm going to hang this up, and we're going to call you right back and try and get you on a better line. Is that all right?
Yeah, you sound great on my end.
Okay, yeah, no, I don't think our listeners can even hear what you're saying, and I want them to. So I'm going to hang up, and we'll try this again. So, and in the meantime, I mean, this is the meme that is now being put out, is that, oh, it's all about regulation or deregulation. And, I don't think that that's really the issue. I think that the government should be the employer of last resort, which is what FDR did with the WPA and the CCC. And I think that we need to strongly regulate both the oil industry, which is allowed to dump its waste in our air at no fee, at no cost, and we should be regulating the banks in a way that takes them back to being the nice, boring old businesses that they were as banks. But, it'll be interesting to hear the argument being made from the right, from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, to see if they have, you know, convince me that we need deregulation. Because it seems to me like we've been having deregulation pretty consistently, pretty steadily, ever since the Reagan administration. And all it's done is got us into a progressively worse and worse and worse situation. So... What's taking so long to get Bill on the line? Okay. So we're trying a different line. We apparently have a bad line, or something. I don't know. But anyhow. Okay. Bill is on line 12. Let's try this again. Bill, say hello.
Thank you, Tom. We had half a bad connection.
You're
coming in loud and clear.
There you go. And you're loud and clear now. So. Make the case. It seems to me that we need more regulation. Our gas and oil companies are dumping their waste in our air, and they don't have to pay for it. Our banks are robbing us blind, and you know, there's not much can be done about it. I don't see where deregulation is the solution to any of this.
we need to do something different. I'm with you on that. The economy is a mess right now, and no one can see a path out. Let's stick with the banks for a while. We have the worst of all possible worlds. We have totally out of control, too big to fail banks that are really in the gambling business. Anybody who pays any attention to the derivatives cascade these folks have built should be terrified, because they could come down again just like they did in 2008.
Well, in fact, I think they will.
And yet, they're supposedly being regulated by folks in Washington who think they can keep up with these messes of the universe, but there's no chance that they can.
No, I absolutely agree with you, but see, they would never have been able to do this. I mean, the derivatives market, the worldwide derivatives market, pretty much didn't exist in 1999, and what small part of it there was about an $80 trillion market. Most of it went through either the Chicago Board of Trade or other regulated and transparent markets. It was the Commodity Futures Modernization Act promoted by Phil Gramm. It was proposed by Ken Lay, and of course Phil Gramm's wife Wendy was on Ken's board of directors at Enron. Ken Lay wanted to get into the business of trading in derivatives, energy derivatives, and he also wanted to open his own bank. And so you had the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that Phil Gramm championed, and the Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which ended Glass-Steagall, which Phil Gramm championed. Now, granted, Bill Clinton signed both of them eagerly, but that deregulation, I would argue, is what has caused the situation you just described. Shouldn't we be re-regulating the banks?
But let's look at the best form of regulation is driving them out of business. So if we want to live in a world that has financial innovation, all right, which I will contend is important for the growth of the economy, it's important for bringing on new businesses, we have to allow people to innovate. But just like in other areas like technology, if the innovators fail, they need to go bankrupt. Their shareholders need to lose all their
money. I'm with you. We never should have bailed out the banks. Totally agreed. But isn't it time then to start applying the Sherman Antitrust Act? I realize that's a regulation too, but you know that's basically how you prevent capitalism from turning into monopoly.
We don't have a monopoly problem except for the fact that the government has set up organizations like Fannie Mae.
Well, no, you've got five banks that have total assets equal to 65% of our GDP. That's not a monopoly.
That's a too-big-to-fail problem, which is caused by the implied, I'm agreeing with you, it's caused by the implied protection of the federal government. We need to take the protection of the federal government away from the banks. Bankers need to fail. People need to know that they could lose their money.
Yeah, but isn't that the essence of Dodd-Frank?
No, Dodd-Frank just does just the opposite. Dodd-Frank enshrines these people.
No, Dodd-Frank has a mechanism for dissolving banks, when they fail rather than bailing them out. It's built right into it. It's explicit in the language. It forbids bailing them out.
This is a fiction to think that it's going to happen. If you look at how it's been changed to monetary policy, which is what's fueling this whole thing, right? In fact, it's monetary policy that's fueling both the too big to fail banks. That fueled the mortgage crisis we had before, and it's going to fuel the mortgage crisis we're going to have again. This is working hand in hand with government involvement in the banking business. Yeah. If you try to embrace them and control them.
So how do we get the government out of the banking business or away from it? We have just 30 seconds, Bill. What's your solution?
That's the right question. How do we get the government out of the banking business? How do we get them out of monetary policy? And
how do we do it?
So that the banks fail just like any other business fails when they screw the public or when they gamble unsuccessfully. That's actually the right question.
What's the answer?
I think we have to start with the Fed, and we've got to get control of monetary policy and stop the money printing, and we've got to withdraw the support of the government from these big banks.
Okay. Well, like I said, I thought Dodd-Frank did that. I guess I need to learn more about Dodd-Frank. Okay, Bill Frezza, the adjunct scholar at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Bill, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you.
Interesting conversation. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
How do you think we should solve our economic problem? I wrote a book on this called Rebooting the American Dream. I'll lay some of my ideas out right after this. Let's just check in and So here's Ted Cruz filibustering on the floor of the Senate. I want to listen to him for just a minute. Let's see what he has to say.
It is apparently an imposition on some members of this body for their constituents to pick up the phone and express their views. It's viewed as somehow illegitimate. How dare they? Apparently,
he's
standing on those
colleagues?
Steps and taking the oath of office invests 100 people with somehow greater wisdom, greater insight, more brain cells.
Why is Ted Cruz picking on his
And our constituents, I get that there's a tendency in this town, particularly as time goes on, to view your constituents as an annoyance. You know, today, just today, I've heard multiple senators complaining, too many phone calls for my constituents. What a remarkable complaint. What a remarkable complaint.
What senator said that? Love to hear. Right?
Mr. President, you and I have both worked in the private sector. The private sector, if your boss picks up the phone and calls, I suspect neither you or I sat on our computer playing solitaire when our boss picked up the phone and called.
Ooh, a dig of John
Neither
Cain.
One of us said, you know, boss, I'm too busy. Boss, I don't want to listen to it. You may have some priorities for the business, but not me. I know better than you. None of us did that because in the private sector, there's a quick and immediate response. You tell your boss in the private sector, hey, boss, my time's too much, too important for you.
Anyhow, enough of Ted Cruz. We'll come back to him a little bit later on. But, he's just speechifying. Basically, I mean, you know, this is I haven't heard a word about Obamacare and how important it is to not have health insurance for the nation. So, I mean, here's what's going on. The Republican Party has become the party of suicide bombers. I mean, you go back to January 20th, 2009, the day President Obama was first inaugurated. 14 Republicans got together in a private room at the Caucus Room restaurant here in Washington, D.C., literally the backside of the building I was living in. Right, lived in a year later, and hatched a plan to sabotage the Obama presidency at every opportunity, no matter how much damage it would do the American people. I mean, the guest list for this four-hour invitation-only meeting were Republican Congressman Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Republican Senators John Kyle, Jim DeMint, who's now the chairman of the Heritage Foundation. A few just vanished from my view. Tom Colburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, and also Frank Luntz, the Republican propaganda guru, was there. And Newt Gingrich. In fact, he came on this program and talked about it. He admitted it. And during that dinner, the Republican conspirators vowed to bring Congress to a standstill, regardless of how badly congressional interaction might hurt the American people or the American economy. In essence, they pledged to each other to obstruct, to filibuster and block any legislation that might improve the economy and make President Obama look good, which is what Ted Cruz is doing right now. Congressman Pete Sessions told the National Journal in March of 2009 that the Republican sabotage plan hatched at the Caucus Room restaurant would borrow a page from the tactics of Taliban terrorists. He said, and I'm quoting a United States Republican Congressman Pete Sessions, quote, Taliban insurgency, we understand perhaps a little more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And these Taliban, this is an example of how you go about changing a person from their messaging to their operations to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the Democrats on the other side. The Texas Republican went on to say, if the Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities, then we will become the insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude. Fast forward to today, get the debt ceiling, the looming government shutdown, 7 days away. There's no chance that the Democrats are going to agree to defund Obamacare. But Ted Cruz is still leading his Taliban-style suicide bomber charge to shut down the government if Obamacare isn't defunded. In fact, here, let's listen to another couple seconds of him. Here he is.
Makes it easier for them to raise their kids, raise them with good values. Makes it easier for them to provide good education for their kids.
Okay, again, nothing about Obamacare.
And when you have one job, It lets you begin to climb the economic ladder to a better job and a better job and a better job.
Right, so why not give people jobs like the WPA and the CCC, you know?
And yet we have tens of millions of people in this country out of work.
Yeah, thanks to Republican policies.
We get the reports from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
32 years of Reaganomics.
That says even more people have given up looking for work.
Well, actually, a lot of them are retiring.
Unemployment statistics work. That makes unemployment, the number of the newspapers report, go down. Because when a...
Okay, Ted Cruz, you know, demonstrating that figures don't lie, but liars can figure. The fact of the matter is, right now, we are seeing one of the most rapid movements out of the labor force in the last 50 years. And it's because the baby boomers are hitting 65 and they're retiring. I mean, there are people who are giving up and not looking for work anymore. But when they say the workforce shrunk by, I think last month it was a little over 180,000 people, a significant chunk of those people simply are no longer in the workforce because they hit 65 and started taking Social Security. But anyhow, Cruz's plan is so crazy that even the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, which typically leans crazy itself, compared his efforts to, quote, a charge into the fixed bayonets, end quote, which, of course, is exactly what the Taliban would do. Cruz's plan to shut down the government is just the latest version of the Taliban insurgency plan that Pete Sessions and his fellow Republican activists hatched back on January 20th, 2009 at the Caucus Room restaurant. Chattanooga Times Free Press has this incredible cartoon. It shows Ted Cruz on the floor of the Senate pulling open his jacket, and inside are all these sticks of dynamite. And he's like a suicide bomber, and he's shouting, "Ayn Rand Akbar!" Right. Ted Cruz, suicide bomber, on the floor of the House. Here he is.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Here he goes.
You know, just a week ago, the Wall Street Journal had a long...
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Cruz is still pontificating about things that are irrelevant and have absolutely nothing to do with defunding Obamacare.
It's not about us. And anyone who is trying to make this a battle of personalities is trying to change the topic from the topic that should matter. Whether or not Obamacare...
Oh, he mentioned it.
...is helping the American people. Mr. President, if you focus on the substance, the evidence overwhelming.
Okay, yes, the evidence... Thank you, Senator Cruz. Okay, so Obamacare has said that you can have your kids on your policy until they're 26 years old, which is really useful for kids in college and who don't have a job, things like that, number one. Number two, it has said that the insurance companies can no longer throw you off the insurance plan if you get sick, no more lifetime caps. When Louise was diagnosed with breast cancer, because of the type of cancer she had, she was put on a chemo drug called Herceptin. It's not even chemo. It's a drug called Herceptin. $100,000 is what that treatment of Herceptin cost. That would wipe out the average family. And for many people with, when you combine that with the cost of the surgery and the chemo and everything else, I mean, with many insurance plans, she would have hit a lifetime limit and she'd be toast right now. Good luck if you ever get a recurrence. Right? God forbid. But Obamacare did away with that. No more lifetime caps, no more period caps, no pre-existing conditions, all these games that the health insurance companies used to play with us are now illegal. And the health insurance companies can't skim more than 20% off the top. You know, the reason that Ted Cruz is going on about this...
Many on the Republican side of the aisle, let us cast a show vote. 2, 3, 10, as many votes as possible.
Now he's picking on the House. Anyhow, the reason why he's grandstanding this, the reason why the Republicans are so hysterical about Obamacare right now is twofold. One, this is the best fundraiser they've ever had. You've got all these right-wing organizations that are sending out letters to their right-wing donor base, to their
they're basically they're you know, easy marks, I guess. I don't know what you'd call it. You know, it's people who are uninformed about Obamacare. They don't know what it does. They don't know what the provisions are. But they do know that it's got Obama's name in it, and they hate him, and so they'll send off their $20 or $50 or whatever. I mean, you know, these organizations are raising millions right now, including Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is raising a huge pile of money on taking down Obamacare. So that's one reason they're going nuts on it. But the big reason they're going nuts on it is because Obamacare, I mean, half of Obamacare has been law for 3 years. It's been phasing in piece by piece. But on the first of the year, the exchanges begin, and it's pretty much done. I mean, it's cooked. And Americans are going to like it. And that's what the Republicans are afraid of. They are afraid that Americans are going to like Obamacare, and they're not going to want it taken away. And so the Republicans, this is why they're saying, oh, just another year delay, please, just, you know, all this stuff. Because they know that Americans are going to like it, and they are scared to death of that. So anyway. Al in Rome, Wisconsin. Hey, Al, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom. Nice to talk to you again. I don't know if too many people noticed it, but this guy that killed those 12 in Washington, if you look into it, the VA kicked him out of two hospitals before he went off.
Oh, really? No, yeah. I didn't. I knew that he had had I didn't know that he'd been kicked out of the hospitals. I know that he had sought help and
no,
that he was on
we don't
a
have health care.
He was on a medication.
Care.
Pardon?
We don't have health care. We have disease care.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And to tie that to the D.C. shooting is not an unrealistic or it's not an exaggeration to say that there may be a relationship. I'm with you, Al. Well said. Thanks a lot for the call. Ed in Burlington, New Jersey. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Yeah, so trying to sit here and watch Ted Cruz, and he's bouncing all over the place. Also wanted to comment on your news broadcast. George Takei is how he prefers to have his name pronounced.
Did I mispronounce his name?
Yes, you did.
How did I say it?
It's Takei. You said Takei. It is Takei.
Oh, Takei. Oh, my apologies. And it's pre-recorded, so it's going to do that for the next 2 hours. I'm so sorry.
Yep.
Thank you for correcting me, Ed. I will
sure.
get it right next
time.
Have a good one. Okay. Is that what you called for?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Ed. I appreciate it. George Takei is one of my heroes. It's just I don't hear his name spoken so much. I read it constantly, but Takei. Okay, I got it. Jerry in Long Island, listening on WWRL. Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? On the threat and government shutdown, it's almost like a science fiction project going on over there because George Takei was in Star Trek.
Yeah.
But on the threat and government shutdown over the funding of Obamacare, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is just political theater and a sideshow because I start off agreeing with you that there's no chance and there's no way Obama and congressional Democrats will agree to go along with Republicans on the defunding of Obamacare. But, and this is what I think we all need to look out for, I think the Republicans are smart enough to realize that there's no way Democrats are going to go away with defunding Obamacare. And so what I think we all need to look out for is the threat of is the Republicans using the threat of a government shutdown or the threat of a debt ceiling crisis next month in October to try to get or gain other type of concessions from congressional Democrats.
Like a chain CPI.
Social safety net programs like Social Security, perhaps Medicare. And we already see the Democrats making concessions with respect to food stamps. For instance, the Republicans we know in the House want to cut food stamps by a lot. So Democrats in the Senate have said, oh, we'll cut it by a little bit. But as far as I'm concerned, during this time of increased need for food stamps by children, disabled people, and the working poor. And by the way, most people who receive food stamps, it's my understanding they fall into one of those three categories.
That's right, 85%.
The majority of people on food stamps are on welfare, but not most are either children. They're too disabled to work, or they're the working poor. They work in the Walmarts and make very little money.
Right.
And so the last thing the food stamp program needs is any cuts at all. And already we see the Democrats, instead of saying leave food stamps alone or let's increase funding for it during this time of increased
right.
economic.
No, you're absolutely right, Jerry. Well, the House wanted to cut $40 billion out of it. The Senate cut $4 billion out of it.
And that was, you know, the Democrats in the Senate. You're absolutely right. And we need to look out for other things coming down the road. You know, they scream and wave the extremist flag, you know, the lance that they're charging at us with of defunding Obamacare. But behind that are going to come, you know, the death of a thousand paper cuts. Let's have a chain CPI for Social Security. Let's cut something, you know, let's begin cutting food stamps. Let's time limit food stamps. Let's time limit, you know, and all these other things. You're absolutely right, Jerry. Absolutely right. Gus in Houston, Texas. Hey, Gus.
Dr. Hartman, I presume.
Yes, thank you very much. I could finally say that.
Tom, it's long overdue, and I just wanted to make a quick sarcastic comment about Ted Cruz, but I halfway expected you to show up in a white lab coat today.
No, it's, yeah, right.
But, Tom, I'm so proud of you, man.
Thank you.
You.
Well, I'm really proud of Goddard College. I mean, Goddard College gave me this degree,
yeah.
And it's their 150th anniversary. And this is one of the most progressive colleges in the United States. If you don't know about Goddard, you need to get over to goddard.edu and learn about it. It's an amazing school.
You know, you're obviously a brilliant guy. You dropped out of high school and college and went on to write several great books, and you've got your PhD, and, man, I just couldn't be more happy for you.
Thank you.
But, Tom, a quick comment about Ted Cruz. I'm wondering, what's with all this anger and animosity toward our beloved senator? He should be commended for doing more to damage the Republican Party than anyone in history. He's managed to accomplish in 3 months what the Democrats have not been able to do in decades. I think we should encourage him in his life and his work. And on behalf of all the intelligent, decent, rational, hardworking Americans, I would like to offer my sincerest heartfelt thanks to our beloved freshman senator. Once more under the breach, dear friends, once more.
Okay, well said, actually, Gus. Good point. Thank you for the call, and thank you for your kind words. Robert, in Portland?
Forest Grove.
Oh, Forest Grove. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, thank you so much for taking my call. Tom, I want to give you some information on the Medicaid expansion that is critical for you to know and everybody in this country. There's a study that was done last year that came out that tells you exactly how many lives are saved by Medicaid expansion. The article, the doctor is Benjamin Summers, S-O-M-M-E-R-S. If you just Google Benjamin Summers on Medicaid, it will pull up the article.
Okay.
But what it shows you is that for every 500,000 people that get coverage under Medicaid, it saves 2,840 lives.
Wow.
2,840.
Wow.
Now, the whole,
which means
article,
roughly every million people who are covered under Medicaid, it saves 5,000 people, roughly.
Exactly. So that in Texas, where he's blocked the Medicaid to over a million people, 5,680 Texans' lives could be saved each year. Now,
and,
let me give
and
you
instead
the
full they
title
won't
of that article. It's called Mortality and Access to Care Among Adults After State Medicaid Expansions.
Okay, great. Well, I'm sure Sue and the folks in the chat room will track it down, and we'll get that out. It'll be on our website or on our app. Robert, thank you for the call. Thanks for the heads up, and thank you for the statistic. Wow, for every million people who get Medicaid, we save over 5,000 lives. And so, what does the governor of Texas want to do? Say, we're not going to take the Medicaid money. The hell with those poor people. Let them die.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Ted Cruz, still going on. Oh well. Ten minutes before the hour. Looking at the second hand rather than the minute hand. Can't do that on TV. Anyway, or on the radio, welcome back. And Joe in Chevy Chase, Maryland, listening on TuneIn. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks. Well, I always enjoy listening to you, but, you know, once again, you only tell one side of the story. I listened to your critique of Ted Cruz's speech, or filibuster, and you're acting like it's a big deal to criticize his colleagues. Well, what do you think Harry Reid does every time he gets up there and wails about those bad old Republicans in the House? Or
yeah, no, I was not criticizing Ted Cruz for criticizing his colleagues. I will criticize his colleagues. What I was doing was pointing out the fact that he was not talking about why Americans shouldn't have access to affordable health care.
That's did you watch the?
Yeah, it's, I know he's gotten into that topic now. He has since we've.
No. But before that, he was couching it affects jobs and why jobs are important.
Right.
I mean, if you cut to a five, you know, if you cut to a 1 minute or a 30 second snippet, of course you can couch it. However,
sure.
You know,
I was kibitzing. You know, we were just picking it up off the live stream. Off CNN,
uh-huh.
So,
uh-huh.
So, okay. So well, you wanted to criticize me for criticizing Ted Cruz? Is that the essence of the call?
No, I mean, you know, but you're taking a cheap shot, and it's
sure.
not a fair thing. And then you also act like Cruz is some sort of, you know, barely functional literate person. He's probably one of the highest qualified. And
he's a Rhodes Scholar.
You know, you all love academics and everything. He blows Obama away as far as academics go.
He's a Rhodes Scholar.
And
he's a very, very smart
really
man.
Irked.
But John McCain
really
thinks that he's a danger to the Republican Party. Why do you think that is?
The Republican Party. I'm not a Republican. I mean, the Republican Party is terrible. I mean, they're you know, a third of them are these institutional. Big government people like McCain and Romney and a whole bunch of other things, and it does need to be shaken up. And
yeah.
Cruz and Lee and those and Rand Paul, those are the guys exactly. They're doing exactly what a lot of us out there, more libertarian bent, really want them to do.
So
I
you would like
no
to see Social Security go away?
Phased out, yeah.
Yeah, and you would like to see food stamps go away?
Not so much on food stamps. That's not a huge thing. But, yeah, I don't see they could be phased
and, out. And you don't think that people should have access to medical care through the instrument of our government?
No.
So
no.
How, if you were, have you ever known anybody who was born into poverty in an area where it's really hard to get out of poverty?
Me.
Okay.
I grew up on a small family farm. My father never made more than $11,000 a year.
Right. And
you don't believe me?
No, I do believe you. I'm guessing that you're white, you know, which gives you a substantial advantage in the marketplace.
What makes you say I'm white?
Well, because, you know, yeah, you can call it racist if you want. It's just that white people are far more likely to make that transition from poverty to the middle class than black people are in this country. And
you're actually making a presumption of my race. Based upon that, I mean that's astounding.
Well, I think I would. No, it's not astounding. Do you know what white privilege is?
If somebody said, oh, you know, I had drug problems in my family, and I come from a single parent family, and I said, oh, you must be black. Would that be a racist statement?
We weren't talking about that. Do you know what white privilege is?
You were making a generalization about my race based upon. Things I said that had nothing to do with
yeah. Do you know what white privilege is?
Yes. Do you know what minority privilege is?
No, I don't.
Affirmative action. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, but I don't think of that as privilege. You know, the average white family in America has assets of about $86,000 a year. The average black family in America has assets of around $5,000 a year. That's
the white family
just a reality.
Steal that money?
Well, yeah, for several hundred years, yes.
Really? So let's assume that I'm Asian, right? And I have more money than an Indian family. I stole that because Asians maybe had a little bit more privilege than
that
Indian
wasn't family. My point. The road I was going down when you decided to take us off on this left turn, as it were, a right turn, was A, are you white? B, did you go to public school? C,
no, I did not.
You did not go to public school. So
no.
you are of the opinion that you have pulled yourself up by your bootstraps all by yourself?
No, I had family help, and I worked really hard. Yeah, most of it.
But the government didn't give you anything, and you think that that's how everybody should be. That there's no reason that the government should be helping.
No, I'm not saying that. I had a huge amount of government loans. I graduated graduate school with a doctorate, and I had about $100,000+ worth of loans 30 years ago.
Right.
Which, if you take it out today, is worth about $350,000 to $400,000.
Right. Well, I congratulate you on having done well. I just don't understand why you think that we should not be providing a basic floor for people to stand on to do well also.
You act like the only place that you can get good things is from the government. And the only place that, the only way to help people is through the government.
I don't act like that. I've never said that. But the fact of the matter is that when you look at the times in the United States when, for example, after Social Security was passed, the poverty rate among elderly people was cut by over 35%. After Medicare was passed in the 1960s, the poverty rate among elderly people went down another 12%. The Great Society cut poverty in half in 6 years.
If people would invest their Social Security funds, they would generally do better. And
if they knew how to invest.
Government is there quite often to subsidize irresponsibility. And if you...
I disagree totally. The purpose of government should be to shepherd or husband the commons and to provide a floor upon which we can stand to rise into the middle class or beyond. There should be a basic, and frankly, I think the government should be the employer of last resort, which is what Franklin Roosevelt did with the CCC and WPA. So, Joe, I guess we have a difference of opinion and a difference of worldviews here. And thank you for calling and sharing yours. We'll be back. It's coming up on 4 o'clock here on the East Coast. And we actually have a debate coming up. This should be entertaining.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Wayne LaPierre is, we're going to be getting to Wayne LaPierre in just a minute. First, I wanted to mention to you that OptimaTaxRelief.com are proud underwriters of the Tom Hartman Program, facing back taxes or IRS liens or bank levies. There's more information over at OptimaTaxRelief.com. And also, Free Speech TV is in a fundraising drive right now. And if you're watching us on Free Speech TV, their telephone number is 877-378-8669. And there are premiums available from Tom Hartman Coffee Cup to books, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, We the People, Unequal Protection, Bernie Sanders' book, Crude Impact movie, a whole variety of premiums for donations of $10, $20, $30, $40, $30, $10, $20, or $30 a month, and then you get everything with a $1,000 donation if you're able to do that and inclined. I mean, but Free Speech TV is an important resource for all of us. And if you're listening on a Pacifica station and they're in a fund drive right now, and I know several of them are, please support them. Please support your local media. So, that said, and welcome back. We just had another mass shooting. In fact, it was just we live in the public marina here in Washington D.C. and just maybe a quarter mile down the Washington Channel, this little extension of the Potomac River is the Navy Yard where this mass shooting happened. And this came out just after a study came out, the largest study ever done, actually. This was done by researchers at Boston University. They compiled data on firearm homicides from all 50 states over a 30-year period from 1981 to 2010. They factored out, this is the first study to ever do this either, they factored out of the study the impact on homicide rates of age, gender, race, ethnicity, urbanization, poverty, unemployment, income, education, income inequality, divorce rate, alcohol use, violent crime rate, nonviolent crime rate, hate crime rate, number of hunting licenses, age-adjusted non-firearm homicide rate, incarceration rate, and suicide rate. They took all of that out of the numbers. And what they found in this first genuine national 30-year study is that, and I quote from the study, for each 1% increase in proportion of household gun ownership,
firearm homicide rates increased by 0.9%. So more guns, more homicides, period. End of discussion. Now, that said, Noel Flasterstein is with us. He is a gun rights advocate, attorney and general counsel for the Second Amendment Club of America, the Florida Carry Consulting Attorney. His website, floridacarry.org, and gunrightsforyou.com. And Noel, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on. And the first thing I'd have to say is, you know, you talked about all these things that they factored out. You know, how many of those homicides were bad guys? How many of those homicides were gangbangers? And quite honestly, when a gangbanger shoots another gangbanger, it really doesn't cause me to lose any sleep at night. In fact, it makes me sleep better.
Well, they took all this stuff out. I mean, it's of the study. What is causing those things that we typically think cause homicides, right? Like being a member of a gang. They said, okay, we're not going to count those. We're just going to look at just raw homicide numbers and take out of the equation all that kind of thing. So, and what they found was more guns, more homicides. Now, they also found more guns, more suicides. And the other thing that I thought was fascinating, Noel, was that they found that in those areas where there are fewer guns, or in those countries like Australia, the big Australian study that was just completed a few months ago, I'm sure you read about that, where, you know, when Australians gave up their guns basically in 1998 after a particularly horrific mass shooting, the suicide by gun rate has dropped dramatically, more than in half, but the suicide by every other technique has not gone up. So absolute suicides went down when the guns went away. So given this information, I don't understand how anybody would not want us to be a less well-armed society.
Listen, I agree. Would we be in a better world without firearms? Of course, by all means.
Well, Australia is.
But that's not reality. That's not the world we live in.
It is in Australia.
And you can't disagree, Tom. You outlaw guns, outlaws are going to still have them. Only the outlaws will have guns. And saying that we take the gun out
of
the mix, we have suicides gone down, well, you know, maybe that accounts for, you know, maybe there's some correlation. What exactly, specifically, I don't know. But that's kind of going on with the same analogy that, you know, the fork made me fat.
Okay.
So let's do away with the fork, and I'm not going to be fat.
Let me offer a suggestion to you. Maybe we can agree on this. I'm not anti-gun, as you know. I do sports shooting with my brother Steve. I enjoy it. I think it's great fun. I'm pretty damn good, actually. And
well, you're my favorite liberal. I will admit that.
Okay, but I do think that, you know, the experience of automobiles should inform us. When cars started getting fast enough that they could kill people back in the 19-aughts and the 19-teens, we said, you know, we've got to do something because all these people were dying in car accidents. And so, you know, we came up with stop signs and red, green, yellow lights and all that kind of stuff. But we also said three simple things. Every car has a registration number that is associated with that car from the time of manufacture to the time of destruction. And somebody has that number attached to them. In other words, it's either a person or a company owns that car, right? That's the title. Number two, if somebody wants to use a car, they have to demonstrate to the you know, in a way that the rest of us recognize that they know how to drive a car. In other words, they have a driver's license, pass a test. But I think the most important part of this is number three, and this is where the free market comes into it. If you're going to use something that can cause harm that may be beyond your ability to pay for, like, you know, your car plows into somebody else's car or knocks over somebody's house, you don't have the money to pay for it, you have to have liability insurance. Similar with a gun. If you damage something with a gun, you can damage things besides killing people, or if you kill somebody. You know, if the Newtown kids had been hit by a drunk driver, GEICO would be paying $1 million apiece to each one of the families. But because they were hit by bullets, nobody's paying those families anything. Why don't we say anybody in America who wants to have a gun can have a gun? If guns all have to be registered, you know, just like cars, so that there's a chain of accountability to the insurance. You have to have a driver's license or a shooter's license. You have to prove you know how to shoot. It's just reasonable stuff.
and you have to have liability insurance. And the insurance companies, and then no federal regulations whatsoever. The insurance companies would, other than that you have to have insurance, the insurance companies would simply say, oh, you've been in a mental institution twice and you've got three domestic violence charges against you. Yeah, we'll sell you insurance. It's $150,000 a year. Or, oh, Noel, you've been shooting for years. You've got a couple of guns. You're really competent. You're very conscious. Your insurance is going to be $25 a year. What's wrong with that?
You know, there's a part of me that is ready to agree with you. And before I could say, oh, you know what, Tom, that's a great idea. The problem with something along those schemes, and I don't have a problem with a gun owner having insurance or maybe even requiring a gun owner to have insurance, but in essence, if we do that, that would kind of, and from my perspective, and I think we do have slight different interpretations of the Second Amendment, with my understanding of the Second Amendment, that the populace be armed, and primarily the reason to do that is to prevent a tyrannical government, it would do away with that safeguard that is in place. Okay. If you had people registered, would that sound very responsible? You know, we're driving cars.
No, we're out of time, but I got your point. I think all of our listeners did, too, and I'll leave you with the last word. Noel Flasterstein, GunRightsForYou.com. Thanks, Noel.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Interesting. Well, we'll see. Would my suggestion run afoul of the Second Amendment? I'd love to see a state try it out and get it taken to to our monarchs, the Supreme Court. It's talk media for the rest of us, for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. The Pope was in Sardinia, which is one of the poorest parts of Italy. In fact, it's the only place where there's still active coal mines. And he was addressing a meeting of the island at the island's main port, Cagliari. A huge crowd, including miners, who were chanting "work, work, work." And so he got up and he said, "This is what the Pope had to say." Now, again, I mean, he's not the most liberal guy. He just excommunicated a priest for advocating gay marriage and said that doctors should not perform abortions, and, you know, if they're going to keep their Catholic faith. It's not like he's become a flaming lefty, but he is shifting the focus of the church to the core teachings of Jesus, in my opinion. He said, where there is no work, there is no dignity. And then he went on to attack capitalism. And, I read this yesterday in the Financial Times. It was on page 4 of the Financial Times. I'm sitting in the airport in Denver waiting for my change of planes and recharging my phone and reading the Financial Times. And I almost, it just stopped me cold. I'm reading this. The Pope, he said, and I quote, this is from yesterday's Financial Times. The headline, by the way, Pope attacks globalized idolization of money. He says, where there is no work, there is no dignity. It is not a problem of Italy and Europe. It is the consequence of a world choice of an economic system that brings about this tragedy. An economic system that has at its center an idol, which is called money. There is a widespread preoccupation with profits and today's throwaway culture that enslaves the hearts and minds of us all. Greed, the Pope said, is a sin against the first commandment. First commandment is, I am the Lord thy God, and you shall have no other gods before me, right? Greed, he said, is a sin against the first commandment. One cannot worship God and money. Here is why. Money becomes idolatry, and Jesus tells us that you cannot serve money and God. It must be one or the other. End of quote from Pope Francis. I asked Sean if she can get Pope Francis on the show. Good luck on that. But, I actually did have a private meeting with Pope John Paul II. So maybe that gives me some Catholic cred. I don't know. We'll find out. But she's calling the Vatican. I seriously doubt Pope Francis will come on, but maybe somebody in his office will. We'll see. We're working on it. Jennifer in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jennifer. What's up?
Hi, Tom. We miss you out here.
Well, thank you. I you know, we still have a house out there and a floating home in the Willamette River, and our son is living in it right now. And so you never know.
We hear you might be coming to Cabo.
We might. I don't. You know, I'm not involved in the negotiations on that. That's being held at, you know, with our with our business people. So
I put a good word in for you at Cabo.
That would be great.
I just had a quick question. You were talking about banking earlier in the program, and I remember you talking about the ability to nationalize the banks, and I was wondering if you could just touch on that, what that would actually mean, and is it a good idea?
The banks could be nationalized. The Constitution does allow for that, or does provide for that, and I'm not sure that it's, and in fact, it was probably the major debate from the time of the Jefferson administration until, or really the Washington administration. I mean, you know, Alexander Hamilton argued for a national bank and got one. And then Andrew Jackson campaigned on getting rid of the first national bank failed. And then there was the second national bank that was created. And I think it was during the Monroe administration. And Andrew Jackson in the 1840s, somewhere in there, so I think it was the late 1830s, campaigned on shutting down the second national bank and succeeded in doing so. Those banks they didn't really provide the Fed kind of function, but what I think should be done rather than our looking at a national bank is that every state should create its own bank. North Dakota did this back in 1916 or 1918, back in the 19-teens. And ever since then, North Dakota has been largely immune to the wild fluctuations of capitalism in the marketplace, because that state-owned bank has always been able to provide loans to people in the state of North Dakota, whether it's farmers or business people or people who want to buy homes. And the profit that that state-owned bank makes from providing loans, from handling the state's money, from, you know, holding the state's pension funds, doing the state's checking, all these things are profitable. That profit all goes back into the state general treasury. So people of the state pay less in taxes and there are more services. If California had its own bank, California has literally trillions of dollars in banks, and, you know, that passes through banks every year, and in addition to pension funds. If they were to create their own bank, the state, I mean, Jerry Brown did raise taxes and the state now does have a budget surplus, although they have, you know, a debt left over from the Schwarzenegger administration. But if they had their own bank, they would be hugely profitable. There's so much that they'd be able to do. Every state should have its own bank and let those banks compete with the corporate banks. And that is going to downsize the corporate banks quite rapidly, quite effectively, and it won't take Dodd-Frank or anything else. It doesn't take the so-called heavy hand of government. You know, it's something that you would think even the libertarians would be behind. Ellen Brown has been pushing for this forever over on her website, webofdebt.com. And I think she's absolutely right. Does that make sense to you, Jennifer?
Are there any states who are doing that?
Washington State is actively considering it in their legislature, and I understand that there are advocates for this in the Oregon State Legislature. I don't know if it's reached the state to the point where it's a piece of legislation. You know, somebody who's really knowledgeable, Carrie Chisholm, you know, over blueoregon.com or .org, I think it's blueoregon.com, would be the person to ask on that. But if it's not, it should be. Jennifer, lead the charge. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the Pope says that this is not a problem of Europe or Italy. It's a consequence of a world choice of an economic system. Capitalism? Yes, indeed, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. I was out at Port Townsend yesterday, Sunday, actually. I was on airplanes all day yesterday. But on Sunday, I was at Port Townsend where Goddard College has their West Coast campus. Goddard.edu is their website, and G-O-D-D-A-R-D. And, boy, if you're looking for a college, this is a unsolicited, unpaid comment. And it's not just because they gave me an honorary PhD. It's the truth. This Goddard is one of the coolest, most progressive colleges around. And I was so honored to receive an honorary doctorate of humane arts and letters yesterday, or day before yesterday. And it's just, you know, if you want to know more, their website, goddard.edu, you can sign up for their newsletter. And if you know anybody who's considering what college should I go to, the way that they teach is extraordinary. I mean, it's self-directed learning. It is a model that should be used K through 12, in my opinion, and in every college in America. They're at the leading edge of innovation, Goddard College. Tanya in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Tanya.
Hi there.
Hey, what's on your mind?
Oh, can you please refresh my memory of the list of towns that have been kind of forced into buying baseball stadiums or football stadiums? In Colorado Springs, they're trying to force us to move the baseball stadium, even though we have one right now. They want us to purchase a new one and put it downtown.
Right. Yeah, I think with the exception of the Green Bay Packers, and that may not be the exception to the rule, but I think it is, because that's the only team that's owned by the community. It's not owned by a billionaire. I think that every other stadium in America was largely built with taxpayer money and largely accrued all of its benefit to the billionaire team owners. So it's, you know,
unfortunately, that's going to happen here too right now.
I'm sorry to hear that. Is there an organized opposition to it? Tanya? Oh, Tanya's gone. Okay. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, hopefully there will be organized opposition to it. Jack in Studio City, California. Republicans as terrorists?
Actually, my question is, do you know whether or not anyone is pursuing legal action against them, the ones holding the nation hostage over single-payer health care and, you know, the underlying interests that are involved in violations of their oaths of office?
Well, I had that conversation with Newt Gingrich on this program about 6 months ago, maybe a year ago, where I asked him, were you part of this meeting at the Caucus Room restaurant the night that President Obama was having his inaugural balls, you know, the day that he was inaugurated? And did y'all plan to do everything you can to bring down the Obama presidency, to destroy his presidency? And Newt said yes. You know, he was proud of it. He said that's what the opposition does. That's why we're called the opposition. It's our job to try to obstruct or disrupt the efforts of the people on the other side. That's our job description. So, you know, not only am I admitting it, I'm bragging about it. I'm proud of it. You know, I'm paraphrasing badly. I can dig out the clip and actually play it for you if you'd like. But
I'd love to see it at some point, really.
Yeah, yeah. But, I could rhetorically call them terrorists, and I can point out that Pete Sessions, who was in that meeting, later said that their goal, that they were inspired by the Taliban and they were going to take on Taliban tactics. But I'm not sure what that signal means. Oh, you've got the clip. Oh, okay. Here's the clip. Here's Newt Gingrich. Here he is. And you were quoted in the book as saying that after this dinner, you'll remember this as the day the seeds of 2012 were sown. Is that all accurate?
Well, part of it.
So were you guys insurgents against the Obama presidency?
Well, the fact is, look, the opposition party ought to sit down and try to figure out how to get back in power. Mm-hmm. That's why they're the opposition party.
So there you go, Jack.
Is anyone calling him on it?
You know, he's proud of it. And in politics, that's what you do. I mean, that's what they did. The last time the Republicans did this was against Harry Truman in 1947. And he called them out on it. He called them the Do-Nothing Congress. And the Republicans didn't have a majority in the House of Representatives for another 46 years because they were so badly tarred by the behavior of that Congress. And I am hoping that we're going to see a repeat of that. I am hoping that America is looking at people like Ted Cruz right now and saying, wait a minute, he's going to stand on the floor of the Senate and yell and scream about my getting, you know, not wanting me to be able to get health insurance at a cheap price. Well, you know, what the heck is going on here? So, you know, yeah, but in terms of anybody doing anything legal, I don't think there's any basis for it, Jack. That's just, it's politics. Jack, thanks for the call. Bob in Riverview, Florida. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I think you're way off base on this auto liability as
insurance
right.
that you'd apply to gun usage.
Gun owners, yes.
Gun owners. Well, auto liability insurance is strictly for negligence. If somebody is sloppy with their driving and negligently causes injury, then auto liability covers.
Right.
And it's very, very limited. I believe the maximum mandatory liability is about $25,000 to $50,000.
Well, I used to have $1 million liability policy when I owned a car.
That's correct. That's because you wanted $1 million.
Oh, you're talking about the legal mandatory minimum. Yeah,
exactly.
And it actually varies from state to state. I'm pretty sure when I lived in Vermont, the legal mandatory minimum was $50,000, but it didn't cost that much more. It was like an extra, $40 a year to take it up to $1 million. And so I figured, what the heck? But
right.
why not come, are you rejecting the idea outright, or are you saying that we need to fine-tune the idea so that the liability insurance that applies to guns reflects the true damage that guns can do?
It would definitely have to be fine-tuned.
I agree.
Auto insurance is for negligence. The gun damage is intentional. And most insurance companies don't like to cover intentional acts.
Well, yes and no. If I know somebody who hit somebody and killed them, and
intentionally?
Not intentionally, no.
Right.
And his insurance company was sued by that person and paid. I mean,
paid, sure. But if it was intentional,
or by that person's family,
he would likely deny insurance coverage.
Okay, well, that's a loophole that you'd have to take out of the gun insurance.
And the other problem with, I feel it's a huge loophole, is in 2005, Congress passed a gun act that gave liability to gun manufacturers, immunity from liability to gun manufacturers.
You're right, and that needs to be undone, too. I totally agree with you, Bob, so that the courts can... I mean, the libertarians, you say, what would you replace regulations with? And they say, the courts, let people sue. And then they go out and say, but let's not have any liability for gun manufacturers. That's crazy. I'm totally with you, Bob. Thank you for the call and for your thoughts. Marie in Astoria, New York. Hey, Marie.
Oh, hi. Hold on. I agree with pretty much everything you say.
But
however, when you bring up with the Catholic Church stuff, it really is offensive to a lot of us victims, because why would you go to an institution for information or advice, bragging rights in this case, because they say, well, maybe someday people can be married if they were priests, when they've been raping and pillaging for the past 2,000 years?
Well, because I see change, and I'm trying to acknowledge the positive change in the Catholic Church. I could do a critique of the Catholic Church just as easily, but I think that there's an old expression, caught you doing something right, and in managing businesses over the years, I've found that it's much more effective, if you want to change somebody's behavior, to point out to them when they've done something right and congratulate them for it, than it is to point out when they've done something wrong. That just over time demoralizes them. Not that the Catholic Church doesn't need to have pointed out, the pedophile priest stuff and all that other things. I think that they're making an effort to clean up their act, but it still is a hierarchical, patriarchal institution. It's got a lot of problems. I don't disagree with you, Marie.
Thank you.
But finally, we have a pope who is saying, let's stop talking about, birth control and gays and stuff and start talking about poverty. Let's have a serious critique of capitalism. That, to me, is astounding. And it's astounding because the Catholic Church has 1 billion members. It is the largest religious organization in the world. And so people take it seriously. And when the head of the largest, even if you've been the head of a bank, when the head of the largest, organization in the world, who claims to speak with moral authority, does so in criticism of capitalism and rich people, I am impressed, and I think it's worthy of acknowledging. Marie, thanks for the call, and thanks for pointing out that there is an other side to the story, because you're right. Mike, in Conifer, Colorado. Mike, we got a minute to the break. It's yours.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Mike.
I want to talk a little bit about the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, and it runs parallel to the study that you were speaking of earlier, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
This is information that is easily available. All you need to do, the listener needs to do, is to, to enter FBI UCR in their browser.
Okay.
And it'll take you to crime reports, which tell you that, for example, every year or annually, and the last year, the last time I looked at it a few weeks ago was 2011, the number of defensive homicides is 200 per year in the United States. So I think it's a fair question to say, are guns really useful? And when I say guns, I'm not talking, as you were speaking of, sports shooting. I'm not talking about hunting.
Right.
And I'm not talking...
Keep going. You got a couple seconds here. Oh. Mike, did we lose you? I guess we lost Mike. Okay. Yeah, I got... You know, Mike, excellent point. And people can get that, as Mike pointed out, the Uniform Crime Reports, FBI UCR. And you can put that into the DuckDuckGo machine and track it down. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Would regulating guns like we do cars and requiring insurance violate the Second Amendment? I don't think so. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and the Talk Radio News Service. On the line with us, Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, and author of the brilliant, if you haven't bought it and read it, do so, book Sideswiped. You really want to know what's going on in Washington, D.C. Anyhow, Bob Ney's news report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, Ellen Ratner's charity. And Ellen, in fact, is on her way to Sudan right now to take pictures of goats and freed slaves to send to people who have made contributions to her charity, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. So, Bob, what's up?
Thank you, Tom. Well, a lot of things. Just to get to one little point, Lois Lerner, central figure in the IRS, Tea Party controversy is gone, so they won't have her around to beat up. And
she resigned? She was fired? What happened?
She quit. She resigned. And I don't see any indicators yet that they said, you know, this is it, you are out the door, but...
Yeah,
she resigned.
She probably got tired of the death threats and the hate mail, and I mean, it's just amazing.
And you know that there was a review board, and they said that neglect of duty, but there was nothing on there that you know that this was a malicious, targeted type of deal. They're just saying, well, maybe she was incompetent for other reasons. So,
right.
But she's gone. And I just wanted to mention that. The big news of the day, the two big news issues. Really, the president gave what I think would be deemed, and he's not going to be criticized that much for it, a pretty intellectual, I would almost say brilliant speech when it comes to world issues at the UN. May not grab a lot of attention because there's not anything in there that's, you know, so controversial, but it addressed Syria. But on top of it, you know, it's the issue of Iran out there. And, of course, the president did not meet with the new president, Rouhani, of Iran, but he's directed Secretary of State to sit down with Mohammad Javid Zarif, who used to be the U.N. ambassador previous under the first moderate president before Ahmadinejad came in. And I mention all this because this is a move by President Obama after some tough sanctions. This is more of a carrot. He's going to be criticized, you know, for this move, maybe with Secretary of State Kerry, but it was a really smart move. And there was one thing the president said, Tom, that just jumped out at me when he said countries have mutual respect for each other addressing Iran. And I say that because the Iranians they have a psychosis to be, quote, respected.
Sure.
And that may seem trite, but at the end of the day, it is a huge deal to them. So I thought this was a good speech the president made. And I think
that's let me tell our listeners, Bob Ney was the only member of Congress who spoke Farsi, the Persian language, the Iranian language, who speaks Farsi. And you know that culture. You know that part of the world. You know Iran. And so if you're saying that this is a big deal, I take that as a very important statement. So thank you for sharing that, Bob.
Thank you. And I think the president's made all the right moves. The other big story is, and this is just amazing, Senator Ted Cruz better quit looking in the mirror saying President Cruz, because the whole Obamacare debate, and this has all went down, and House Republicans put it in the continuing resolution to defund, you know, the Obamacare. It goes over to the Senate, and lo and behold, Mitch McConnell, who nobody has heard from for quite a while, the minority leader, the Republican in the Senate, is giving votes, along with others, for Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, to be able to bring this whole debate to the floor. Now, once that happens, the provision defunding Obamacare is going to be removed. And so Senator Cruz really can't point the finger anymore, and this is realized on the Hill. This whole Obamacare thing's over, Tom, because he can't point the finger and say the Democratic side, et cetera. His own Republicans in the Senate said, that's it.
Mitch McConnell gave up Ted Cruz, basically. Now, he was filibustering. I mean, I was playing little clips of his filibuster a half hour ago or so. Is he still on the floor of the House, do you know?
I think he's still there. But Mitch McConnell gave him up, put him on the highway, ran the bus over and back over again just to make sure. And that's really about the only way to describe it, because how on earth now can, well, Cruz will say some things, but he has to go full force filibustering because it's done now.
Yeah,
I mean,
the whole thing
went through the system.
So all Cruz is doing right now really is fundraising. I mean,
fundraising and saving his own political career within his Senate.
Right.
You know, he's not going to be president of the United States, but just keeping, quote, the fight because he's going to fight it to the end. He channeled Churchill the other day, as they said in the media, and he's going to keep fighting to the end. But to be honest,
is there any chance that he's going to slow this thing down enough that it's not going to get back to the House in time for a vote that would send it to the president in time to sign so that we hit the wall on October 1st?
No, I mean, the Senate will take some time on this and I think intentionally deliver it to the House with 1 or 2 days to go. You know, why? That's a good strategy. Why give the House time?
Right.
But they'll do that. But I don't think Cruz, he himself can extend it to that.
And then the House will pass it with maybe 20 or 30 Republican votes and all the Democrats.
The Democratic votes, and then Boehner, the Speaker, will have to go around the, quote, Hastert rule, where you have to pass it with your own party's votes.
Right.
The former Speaker Hastert, we used to call it the Hastert rule.
Right. But he's done that before.
Yes, and he's going to do it again because he doesn't want the government shut down. But I just thought it was interesting because this is an eat-your-own thing.
Yeah.
Senator Cruz cannot blame anybody. You know, they need 60 votes to bring a measure to the floor. There's not 60 Democratic members. So I think the Senate's Republican leadership is saying to Senator Cruz, okay, that's it. That's enough.
Yeah, yeah. At least until he shuts down, after he shuts down, shuts up and sits down. Yeah.
Right. And then,
they're going to let him have his moment in the sun.
That'll take a while.
Yeah.
And the only other news was the Kenya mall attack, and you know the terrible aftermath of that, and whether there are actually Westerners in there. You know, there's speculation there were American.
Is it still under siege?
No, it's come to its conclusion, and two of the floors fell in, but they're still looking to see. They're trying to find out if there were Westerners because there was all this speculation from the Kenya government. And
right.
So I think that'll be looked at. We have FBI agents over there.
Yeah, this was an upscale popular mall that American expats and visitors, tourists shop at as well. So very interesting. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Congressman, thank you so much. And once again, let me remind people, you wrote a brilliant book called Sideswiped. They need to check it out. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks.
Talk to you soon. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
In conservative, had an interesting discussion a little earlier about gun control. I continue to think that the way to do this is to, and to bring in the right wingers, even, is to simply say that guns have to be licensed. You have to have a driver's or a shooter's license to use one, and they have to be insured. Liability insurance. And that liability insurance will become the regulator. You don't need the government regulating it. Because the insurance company is going to say, oh, you've got two domestic violence convictions? Yeah, we'll write you a policy for your gun insurance. It'll be, you know, $10,000 a month. At which point the person says, well, I don't think I'll buy a gun. Or they'll say, oh, you're a responsible, you know, hunter or sports shooter or something like that. Policy will be $45 a year, which the in case the person says cool. So anyhow, we talked about that. We talked about deregulation, the Conservative Enterprise Institute coming on the program and saying that our economic woes are from deregulation. And I'm like, I don't get that. We deregulated our banks and they crashed our economy. How do we need more deregulation? I don't think got a clear answer to that from CEI. And we talked about the Pope. The Pope says that the problem, it is not a problem of Italy and Europe. It is a consequence, the consequence of a world choice of an economic system that brings about this tragedy, an economic system that has at its center an idol, which is called money. It's amazing. He said there's a widespread preoccupation with profits that enslaves the hearts and minds of all of us. Greed is a sin against the first commandment. One cannot worship God and money. Here is why. Money becomes idolatry, and Jesus tells us that you cannot serve money and God. It must be one or the other. Period. End of sentence. Pope Francis. Speaking of South American, he's from Argentina. Speaking of South American famous people, the president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff, spoke this morning at the United Nations. She delivered a powerful indictment of spying by the NSA on behalf of the United States. She said, and I quote, "Without respect for a nation's sovereignty, there is no basis for proper relations among nations." She added, "Brazil knows how to protect itself, and Brazil does not provide shelter to terrorist groups. We are a democratic country." The Brazilian president was so outraged at the American spying, both on her country and on her personal emails and her personal life, that she canceled a state dinner with President Obama. And while most Americans see this as a rift between Brazil and the United States over the issue of spying, our spying on Brazil, President Rousseff highlighted the most important point of all elsewhere in her speech this morning. She said, and I quote, "Without the right of privacy, there is no real freedom of speech or freedom of opinion, and so there is no actual democracy." End of quote. President of Brazil. This is not just true of international relations. It's also true here inside the United States. I mean, back before the Kennedy administration largely put an end to it, J. Edgar Hoover was infamous in political circles here in D.C. for his spying on and blackmailing both American politicians and activists, like, for example, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. He even sent King tapes of an extramarital affair and suggested that King should consider committing suicide. And that was a shameful period in American history. And most Americans think it's behind us. But the NSA and other intelligence agencies and even local police departments have put the practice of spying on average citizens in America on steroids. This is not good. As Brazil's president points out, without privacy, there can be no democracy. Democracy requires opposing voices. It requires a certain level of reasonable political conflict. And it requires that government misdeeds be exposed. And that can only be done when whistleblowers and people committing acts of journalism can do so without being spied upon. And in fact, I think a larger problem here is that well over half, some estimates run as high as 70% of the NSA's budget has been outsourced to private corporations. These private corporations maintain an army of lobbyists here in Washington, D.C., who are constantly pushing for more spying and thus more money for their clients. So with the privatization of intelligence operations, the normal system of checks and balances that would keep government snooping under control has broken down. We need a new church commission to investigate the nature and scope of our government's spying, both on us and on people like President Rousseff of Brazil, our allies. But even more than that, we need to go back to the advice that President Dwight Eisenhower gave us as he left the presidency in 1961. Eisenhower warned about the rise of a military-industrial complex, suggesting that private forces might, in their search for profits, override the protective mechanisms that keep government answerable to its people. That military-industrial complex has become the military-industrial spying private prison complex. And it is far greater a threat to democracy than probably was even envisioned by Eisenhower. In American democracy, in our republic, our government is the protector of the commons. It is of, by, and for we the people, and therefore it must be answerable to we the people. When the functions of government are privatized, all of that breaks down, and our government then becomes answerable to profit, which is not the idea of government. So we need to reestablish this very bright dividing line between government functions on the one hand and corporate functions on the other, between the public space and the private space. Government should be doing spying, not private corporations. Government should be running prisons, not private corporations. Government should not be making cars. That should be private corporations, or making clothes, or selling toothbrushes. I mean, that's all private corporations. And a critically important place to start that whole process is by ending the privatization within our national investigative and spying agencies. Get these spy corporations out of the business. Because they're not, I mean, they're not only are they not answerable to you and me, their mission, arguably by law, I mean, go back to, you know, Dodge v. Ford and the Michigan State Supreme Court back in the 30s, I think it was. By law, they have to answer to profit first. So you've got a corporation that is spying on people, you know, like the one Ed Snowden worked for, or the one the shooter Navy Yard worked for. Apparently, both of them really worked for companies that were contracting to other companies that were contracting to the government. And it's like there's this whole giant gravy train that the Navy Yard shooter, I think, was three levels deep in. He was working for a little company that was working for a bigger company that was working for HP that had this contract with the federal government, if I'm recalling my chain of command correctly. Why? I mean, if we're going to have spies, if we're going to have people doing, and the company that vetted both Ed Snowden and the Navy Yard shooter, is the same company. It's a private corporation. We've privatized our security, our background checks. This is nuts. It's time to bring back the public space. So, anyhow, my rant for the day. We'll be back with more of the news of the day, your calls, and my thoughts on all of the above.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And a special thanks and shout out to Goddard College, who Sunday gave me an honorary PhD in Humane Arts and Letters, goddard.edu. Great school. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Don't even consider it. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So let me just, where did my newscast go? I wanted to get into this a little bit. The president gave a speech today at the General Assembly of the United Nations, which was Bob Ney came on and who speaks Farsi, the Persian language. And he said, thank you, Jim. He said, this is a big deal that the president talked about. We in Iran must treat each other with mutual respect. Because in the Persian culture, in the Iranian culture, respect is way up there. I mean, we have, every culture has things that they give lip service to as, not just lip service, things that they value highly. In the United States, we value, and I think sometimes a little too highly, freedom, for example. And the reason I say a little too highly is because I think some people's notion of freedom is not a reasonable notion. It's you know, free to die like a dog without health insurance in the gutter. You know, I don't think that's freedom. But in any case, America gives a lot of lip service to freedom. Iran does the same for respect. And the president used that word this morning. That's a big deal. Also, you know, when this is incredible. When the Republicans sent their defund Obamacare continuing resolution to continue to keep the government operating back to the Senate or over to the Senate, they kept in it the Monsanto Protection Act. Now, the Democrats in the Senate are going to vote on this thing and send it back to the House, and they're going to strip out the part that says no funding for Obamacare. I'm wondering if they're going to strip out the part that says, you know, another 3 months for the Monsanto Protection Act. So we will try to find out. Wayne in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
I was just calling about the Alberta tar sands and the Keystone Pipeline controversy.
Mm, right.
One of the things that I have seen in different documentaries is the vast pools of the byproduct that comes from mining or processing tar sands.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Keystone Pipeline goes through, I was wondering which state is willing to take those pools and put it in their state, and what are they going to do with those, the process?
You mean the consequence of the refining process?
Yes.
Yeah, it's going to be Texas.
Texas is going to take those.
Yeah.
That,
I mean,
pits.
Yeah, and they're going to put and they're going to pump as much of it into the air as they can, so that downwind and Louisiana gets a lot of it. I mean, you've got Cancer Alley downwind from all those refineries, and all this, by the way, so that they can. The reason that they're trying to get that oil to the Gulf Coast is not because America needs it. I mean, we've already got a Keystone Pipeline that's going to St. Louis and then over to Ohio, where there are refineries. For American, you know, for diesel fuel for the United States, but they want to get it down to the Gulf Coast so that they can load it on tankers and export it. It's purely for export.
Okay.
And TransCanada has come right out and said that when this happens, the price of gasoline in the United States is going to go up because their refineries in the Midwest are going to go, you know, they're going to be producing less oil and they're going to be sending more of it for export. So.
Right. I think the first thing that Canada is going to do if that pipeline ever goes through is to drain their ponds.
Could be. Could be. It's going to be. And let's hope they don't drain them to the south. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. And Andrew in Los Angeles, listening on KPFK. Hey, Andrew, what's up?
Hey, Tom. We spoke last week regarding the use of petroleum products for plastics.
Yes.
And using alternatives. I just wanted to continue on that discussion.
Okay.
Because I think most Americans, maybe most people, really don't know much about this and would be shocked to find out that we can actually make plastics out of plant-based oils and other products.
Not only can we do.
We do, exactly.
Yeah.
And we need to spread this knowledge, because I think it would be so easy to replace petroleum products, not only for fuel, but for everything else. For it's used in fertilizers, it's used in body care products. People spread it on their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
It's used, like I said, for fertilizer. We're feeding it to our plants. Which
pesticides, herbicides, all that stuff.
Yeah. Exactly. Most pesticides, herbicides are petro-based. So I think we really need to spread the knowledge that we don't need to be sucking oil out of the ground, because even though we burn it and it's polluting, if we don't burn it, once it comes out of the ground, it spills all over the place, like Exxon,
yep.
Oil Valdez and BP,
yep.
You know, in the Gulf. So we need to stop using these products, and it could be done. And I think when people find out about this, it should be easy to do. So
I'm absolutely with you, Andrew, and thank you for calling and making that point. Marco in Deltona, Florida. Minute to the break, Marco. It's yours.
Hi, Tom. I just have a question. I was wondering how it could not be considered that people that try to actively shut down the American government can't be seen as traitorous or terrorist to shut down an entire government.
You know, I have referred to some of the people who, particularly the last time that, you know, there was this whole fight over the debt ceiling, as both traitors and terrorists. But it's really a rhetorical argument. It's not. I don't think that they should be prosecuted for either terrorism or for treason. It's politics. And, you know, when somebody does something politically that other people don't like, you know, that's a bad thing. I mean, I pointed out, you know, the causality, for example, if you knock 3 million people off food stamps, you're going to see probably a couple thousand extra suicides. So I pointed out that these Republicans in the House of Representatives who want to cut $40 billion out of food stamps, out of SNAP, are actually causing deaths. We could call them murderers, too. But the fact of the matter is that we have this political process in the United States, and rather than being inflammatory rhetorical, we need to get involved in the political process.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That said, Ted Cruz does in many ways resemble somebody with a suicide vest on right now. I mean, you know, he's just really taking lessons from the Taliban. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And as gun ownership goes up, homicides go up. This is like not even a debate anymore. And Wayne Little Peter, is out there running around saying there weren't enough good guys with guns at the Navy Yard shooting. Really? You have the clip of that? Here it is.
This was the Navy Yard. There were armed guards there, Mr. LaPierre. Does that not undermine your argument?
No, the whole country, David, knows the problem is there weren't enough good guys with guns.
Right, not enough good guys with guns. See, if everybody had a gun, we could have had, you know, another half a dozen or so civilians killed. Accidentally, you know, you ever heard of crossfire? Yeah, let's put a gun in everybody's hands. This guy's nuts. Well, he's not nuts. He's paid $2 million a year to say this stuff, and he's doing a very good. He's getting, you know, the NRA, the national lobby for the gun, for the weapons manufacturing industry, is getting their money's worth out of Wayne LaPierre. Richard in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Fine. What's on your mind?
I was just at my father came up from down in Detroit, and he was telling me my uncle works for one of these seismic companies that does seismic testing for fracking purposes.
So they're measuring earthquakes, or they're measuring just, you know, where the fracking should be done using dynamite kind of explosions to map the
and probably thumping machines and stuff like that.
Right.
But according to him, that 3,000 feet below all the shale is vast pools of oil.
In Michigan.
Maybe even more than what's in Saudi Arabia.
Huh.
And I don't know if it's true or not. Like I said, this is I'm kind of catching this on a hearsay thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I've torn to my uncle before. Is money really worth the destruction of our land and just killing people, even if the people want it done on their property?
Right, or the destruction of our planet. I mean, look at the consequence of burning these fossil fuels, taking this stuff out of the ground that's been there for hundreds of millions of years, this carbon.
That's where it belongs.
And putting it into the atmosphere. It should stay in the ground. I'm with you, Richard. Thanks for the heads up on that. You know, Michigan, when I grew up in Michigan, there were actually oil wells in the 1950s and 60s. Most of all of them have been capped now because they pretty much pumped them out. But they were fairly surface. But it wouldn't surprise me if there was a lot of more oil at depth. Richard, thanks for the call. Fascinating. Candy in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Hey, Candy, what's up?
Hi. I work with a geotechnical engineer the last 38 years. In the last 15 years, we've been going to the tire sands. And I don't think I was talking to your caller before. The ponds that he's talking about are the residual effects of for them to take the oil out of the sands.
Right.
And they can't. There's two statistics. For every one barrel of oil, it's 7 to 10 barrels of polluted water that they have destroyed from the Athabasca River, that there is no cure, no solving it, no cleaning it up, no doing something with it. They've tried. They can't even solidify it so you can walk on it.
Wow.
And I people just don't understand. It's the worst stuff to clean up. You know, we had an oil spill of the tar sands oil in Arkansas a few months ago. Mm. Nobody knows about it. They don't know what to do with it.
Right. Same thing with the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. It's still a crisis years later because the stuff sinks rather than floats.
Why we're even doing any? Why we're even thinking of allowing this to go across our land? I just right. don't understand it.
Because there's big money to be made.
There is big money to be made, but I just don't know why we should pay for Canadian oil to go across the United States to be shipped to China.
I just don't
understand that.
I'm with you. And you might want to call President Obama and ask him to explain that, too, because it makes no sense to me. Candy, thank you for the call, and thank you for your passion. Dan in Stockton, California. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am fine.
I heard a news story this morning on the net about this 95-year-old guy,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't want to go get this certain surgery, right? Hello, you there?
I'm listening.
Okay. Well, his family ended up calling the police, and these police tasered the old fellow, shot him in the stomach with a shotgun or a beanbag.
Mm-hmm.
And they killed him.
Whoa. Because he was, cranky and didn't want to go to the hospital kind of thing? Is that?
Well, the surgery he was facing is an iffy kind of surgery anyway.
Yeah, and he was 95.
And the 95-year-old guy, he shouldn't have to go get a surgery if he doesn't want to, right?
Right. I'm with you. That's amazing. Well, see, this is a classic example of what Abraham Maslow said back in 74. When the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. If you call the police, what do they have? They've got guns. And, you know, guns in jails. That's pretty much it. And that's a real tragedy, Dan. Thank you for sharing the story with us. I'm sorry to hear about it. Janet in Topeka, Kansas. Hey, Janet.
Oh, hi. I want to congratulate you on your PhD with Goddard.
Thank you.
Our youngest daughter. It's a great school.
Your youngest daughter went to Goddard?
She is now, and she's decided to make Vermont her home. She bought a house up there and is very well employed in her profession, which is special education.
Uh-huh.
But it's a great school. A lot of people think it's easy. It's not. It's very rigorous because it is the Socratic method that dialogue between the mentor and the student and the research and the writing and all of that, it's tough.
Yeah.
But the other issue is the Roman Catholic Church, of which I'm a member.
Mm-hmm.
And this Pope is a Jesuit. And it's almost, it's not ironic, it is a historical fact that the Jesuits, Francis Xavier, who founded the Jesuits, came in and cleaned up the Vatican right around the Renaissance during the Reformation. There was a counter-reformation.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the Vatican was unbelievably corrupt, you know, concubines and you name it,
right. And
selling indulgences, all of that stuff. But the Jesuits came in there and cleaned it up. And I think that's kind of what's going on now, you know. And I think this Pope is wonderful. The Jesuits also have been in and out of touch with the Catholic Church. I don't know if you followed that. I've read a lot of Chartrand, Théologie Chartrand.
Mm-hmm.
But one of their things, I mean, they were primarily missionaries and teachers.
Yes.
And in South America, during the dirty wars down there, they were proponents of liberation theology,
mm-hmm.
which was communism, and, you know.
Or perceived as such,
and,
yeah.
Yes, yes, and rounded up and hunted down, and many of them were killed.
Okay.
So, you know, they've always, Jesuits are great.
Yeah, wasn't Father Berrigan a Jesuit? The great anti-nuclear, anti-war campaigner here in the United States?
Yes. There, a lot of them are scientists. Chardin was a scientist, paleontologist, and, you know. But they...
Have there been any other popes recently who came from that Jesuitical order who were Jesuits?
No.
Interesting.
No, there hasn't been. I think this is the first Jesuit that a pope, designated pope. But historically, the Jesuits have been in and out of favor with the Vatican. You know, there were times where I think they were disbanded at one point, because they've always been that critique.
Right.
You know, that.
Right. And they've been the intellectuals of the church. Janet, fascinating stuff. I thank you for the call, and thank you for sharing that. I just have 1 minute. I want to get another caller in here, if I may. Carrie in Schoolcraft, Michigan. Hey, Carrie. What's up? Carrie?
Hey. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Carrie. Got a minute. It's yours.
What?
We have a minute to the break, and it is yours.
Okay. I'm in Upper Michigan. I was just wondering how many guns the Republicans will need in order to properly protect us from 6- and 7-year-olds, you know, such as in Connecticut. You know, what is the need? Where?
Right.
Is there?
Right. In other words, you're pointing out the craziness of Wayne LaPierre's suggestion that if everybody had a gun, there wouldn't be any gun violence.
You know what happened?
What's that?
Everybody had a gun, everybody was informed what's going on. Okay, so you had
Carrie, we're out of time. I'm sorry. I thought that might be a short point. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So is Ted Cruz going to filibuster as long as Wendy Davis did? How's Wendy Davis doing, by the way? I get occasional emails from her because I sent her some money. Welcome back. Ted Cruz continuing to blither. I can just bring him up a little bit in the background.
For our husband's health insurance, we wouldn't say, well, let the system collapse because in time there'll be a political victory. I guarantee you, if it was our spouse's, if it was your daughter's or your son's health insurance, particularly if they had significant health issues, not a one of us would be serene saying, well, let it collapse.
Then why are
because
you saying...
Because we want to immunize ourselves from the criticism, or because we all want to ultimately move to socialized medicine.
Yeah, okay. Ted Cruz, he's continuing his rant. And I thought it was very interesting that former Congressman Bob Ney came on this program just about an hour ago this minute and said that when Mitch McConnell, the leading Republican in the Senate, said to Harry Reid, go ahead and have a vote, bring this thing to the floor. We will not object to your bringing this piece of legislation to the floor. It means that it's going to be the anti-Obamacare stuff is going to be stripped out of it, which means that Mitch McConnell basically put the shiv into Ted Cruz. But Ted Cruz is going to continue with his little rant because, hey, it's raising money. It's getting publicity. He's trying to turn himself into a kingmaker. This is one slick politician. This is one smart guy. Doug in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Doug. This is on KBCX.
Well, hi, Tom. Can you hear me all right?
I do. What's up?
Okay, great. An issue with this gun control and something I came up with that might satisfy everybody. The right or the gun proponents always complain about the fact that any regulations are going to be oppressive on the law-abiding gun owners. Well, what if any crime that took place involved a gun automatically was a life sentence. And anybody that might get killed by a gun would automatically be a death sentence. If you're law-abiding, there wouldn't be any argument then.
Yeah. Well, there are, I mean, most states have provisions that when you use a gun in the commission of a crime, the penalty is greater, anywhere from a year to 20 years, 5 years, I think is probably the average around the country. So the use of a gun in the commission of a crime amps up that crime. But if everybody knew that it was an automatic life sentence, maybe. I'm not so enamored, Doug, of the idea that threatening people with jail is the successful way to solve problems. We have the highest incarceration rate in the world, arguably in the history of the modern world. We have a higher incarceration rate than South Africa did during apartheid. It is not working, putting people in jail. And so I think that rather than dealing with the problem at the level of we're going to put you in jail if, we should instead be dealing with it. I think we should deal with guns the way we deal with cars, you know, register them, license them, and insure them. And that defines a marketplace. And within that marketplace, the insurance companies will become the regulators of the guns. And I think that that's an entirely appropriate thing. But interesting idea, Doug. Thanks for calling and suggesting it. Charles in Vancouver, Washington, listening in on the stream of our Albuquerque affiliate, apparently. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Got to say, really appreciate not just what you say, but the tone with which you say it. Civil discourse is woefully on the wane in this country. I actually am living in Langley, British Columbia, and I'm still employed in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which puts one of each of my feet on either side of the border and kind of makes me a lot more ambivalent about the whole XL issue than I would otherwise be, because from my perspective at home and from my family's perspective in British Columbia, the alternative to the XL pipeline through the heartland of the United States is one right through some of the most pristine wildernesses and into the most pristine waterways in our province, in British Columbia and in Canada.
Well, there's a third alternative, and that's leave that stuff in the ground.
Well, that's never going to happen. Because you have a conservative government in Canada that has an electoral mandate in Parliament, a majority mandate that extends until 2017. And Mr. Harper is himself, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with the functionality of a Westminster-style parliamentary democracy, but Mr. Harper is not elected by a majority of Canadians. He is instead elected by a plurality of people in his district in Calgary. And what, you know, whichever way things should go for Calgary tends to be the way that Mr. Harper wants things to go for
in Calgary's oil country.
Calgary is, yes, and Calgary, Alberta, and Alberta is the Texas of Canada, as we are often saying. Calgarians tend to say that with pride. British Columbians tend to say it with a bit of a sneer in their voice.
Mm-hmm.
And Alberta has always resented the fact that it has both a blessing and a curse, and that is that while its riches lay in the ground, payments for those riches always lay across the sea, and it is entirely landlocked. So your choices are either to run a pipeline through the center of the United States, run it west across British Columbia, which our own premier, which is...
Well, here's a question, Charles. If these guys are all so gung-ho about getting this oil out of the ground, these tar sands oils out of the ground, why don't they just refine it there in Alberta and then sell the refined products?
That's a good question. There's a brother or a relation of Conrad Black, who's the newspaper magnate, and he has posed a very similar question and said, look, if you want to run this garbage through our backyard, and he's looking at proposals in British Columbia, he said, well, you know, let's deal with it this way. Let's refine it, because
right.
Then you get the value added. You know, we understand that you need the Chinese, because that's really where this oil is going to, Tom. It's going to the Chinese.
Right.
And it's going to get to the Chinese, whether it goes off the Gulf of Mexico, the Pacific Coast, or even if they have to, they're actually talking about reversing pipelines and sending it east. That's how desperate and resolved this government is.
Wow. Not to mention huge train loads of the stuff.
Well, and I'm sure you may have caught a little bit about the explosion in Lac La Gantique, which basically leveled the town square because of all of that.
Amazing.
So it's a much more complicated issue.
Yeah, apparently. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to the program. We'll be back tomorrow. Right wingers in the House have voted to cut $4 billion out of America's food stamp, actually $40 billion out of America's food stamp program. How can we justify that? I'm going to challenge Fran Smith of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It really does require you to be a member of it. Find the area of your passion and throw yourself into it. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.